underway. Good morning. And just before I return to the submitters, reporting officers, anything for us this morning?
No.
All right. Well, good morning and welcome. Today we're hearing from the territorial authorities. Would you like to introduce yourself to us?
Yes, good morning. Michael Gabbard is my name. I'm council instructor by the three territorial authorities, Southland District Council, Gore District Council and Invercargill City Council. And I'll coordinate the presentation on behalf of the local authorities this morning.
Great, thank you. And thanks very much for pre-circulating both your legal submissions and all of the evidence from the witnesses that you've called in. We've read all of that material. You're probably pleased to know you don't need to read any of that out to us, because that would serve no point because we've already read it.
Yes.
What we've done with other witnesses who have pre-circulated material is we've asked if they have any corrections or additions to their evidence, and then we've just proceeded straight to questions.
Yes.
How would you like to run your case this morning?
Yes, so firstly, thank you very much to the panel for allowing us extra time. It's a critical issue for the TLA, and we're very appreciative of that, so thank you.
That's fine.
What I'd like to do is I've pre-circulated some legal submissions. I'd like to work through those. I've also provided you this morning a hearing order, and there's copies available. So what we intend to do is work through the order that we've presented there. We've got 12 witnesses. We thought we'd start with the political representatives, then the senior staff, and then to the experts at the end. I've given an estimated time. That's obviously subject to questions, of course, from you.
Yep.
And we've asked each of the witnesses to be prepared to present a one-page summary of their evidence to highlight the key points and anything that's arisen that they'd like to respond to. So we'd like the opportunity to allow each witness to be able to do that, just to present those highlights to you. Most of them have prepared a one-page summary, but some of them haven't. And some of the witnesses are short, less than 2 pages, so we'd like them to highlight the key points out of those parts of their evidence too.
Yeah, look, that's fine. We've got all day, and we understand the importance of the case. You made them to us, and with all the other submitters, we've allowed them to highlight their key points to us. So the fact you've written those down for us, that's helpful.
Okay, thank you. So I'll start with my legal submissions. I understand you've all been provided a copy.
Yep, we've all read them everywhere.
Oh, you've read them.
Yeah, right. I keep them.
So I do want to go through paragraph 2 because that does really highlight why we're here from the TLA's point of view and the key messages really. So the fundamental issue is that the TLA's request that the draft plan is changed to what they see as a more appropriate provision for their three waters infrastructure. In particular, the policy and rule framework leads in most cases to non-complying activity status for consenting or reconsenting the stormwater and wastewater infrastructure required to serve their communities. The TLAs consider that ultimately the critical nature of this infrastructure justifies a discretionary activity status so that the merits of the proposal can be considered in light of the applicable policy framework existing at that time. And one of the key issues, of course, is that the TLAs see running the gauntlet of the gateway test for resource consent applications for such infrastructure runs a serious risk that any effects on the environment might be considered more than minor, and any proposal contrary to the current thrust of the policy framework. This would preclude the merits of such a proposal being considered by rejection of that gateway test. From a resource management point of view, the TLAs consider that it's not realistic, not consistent with the higher order policy framework, and nor consistent with the purpose of the Act. Set out in para 3, the context. I don't propose to read through that. I think you've obviously read that and read the evidence of the witnesses, but the key point really is that what we're dealing with on behalf of the TLAs is the in-ground and discharge infrastructure, particularly for stormwater and wastewater. That infrastructure is not nimble. It's been built up over generations and invested by previous generations to the point it is at today. And some of that infrastructure was built under standards of earlier times and has been built upon and is constantly being renewed. So it's not an infrastructure that the council can just renew in an easy way. In terms of the policy framework, I highlight three particular provisions out of the proposed RPS, and I understand, and staff can advise you on this, that these provisions are beyond challenge.
Yep.
But this sets the framework, and there's a couple of issues in there I'd like to specifically highlight. In terms of infrastructure one, the key part there is from the second line, critical infrastructure is secure, operates efficiently, and is appropriately integrated with land use activities in the environment. So there's the nature of secure and efficient operation comes through. Moving to the subsequent policy, this whole policy really does encapsulate this issue from the TLA's point of view, and our message to you is that this plan strikes the balance about right. So policy infrastructure one, to recognise the benefits to be derived from and make provision for, and I highlight make provision for. So there's a, it's a verb, there's an active provision for the development, maintenance, upgrade and ongoing operation of regionally significant, nationally significant and critical infrastructure. And we're really dealing with critical infrastructure in my submission. And then the following policy, where practicable, so there's an element of subjectivity and appropriateness comes through where practicable. Avoid, remedy or mitigate the adverse effects of infrastructure. And the where practicable is important to bear in mind because some of this infrastructure, for example, discharge to land, may in fact not be practicable in certain soil types or in certain locations. So that is a flavour that the TLAs see as particularly important and do see it recognised in the proposed RPS, but unfortunately don't see it recognised in the proposed land and water plan, and would like to see some of these concepts flow through. So I've summarised in para 7 some of the key points which I've just really highlighted there from that overarching document. So in my paragraph 8 I summarise that by saying overall it's submitted that these principles cast the issue in the correct light and appropriately recognise the benefits and importance of providing for ongoing operation of the infrastructure while appropriately managing adverse effects on the environment. So the issue that the councils see with the proposed water and land plan is that fundamentally it does not appropriately strike the balance right for the infrastructure in a manner consistent with this higher order document. The draft plan, in practical terms, will render most wastewater and stormwater infrastructure consents a non-complying activity. And fundamentally the TLAs take the position that this is not appropriately recognising the benefits and critical nature of the infrastructure, and nor, and this is my key point, does it make provision for the development, maintenance, upgrade and ongoing operation of that infrastructure. I set out in 10 why that's so important, and I just highlight the gateway test, and I'm sure you're all familiar with how that operates, but there's those two key limbs.
No, we're very familiar with that.
And in 11, it is conceivable that an application for discharge consent might be refused at the gateway test. Without the merits of it even being considered. When preparing for consenting applications, these are complicated. They take a long time to research, prepare, notify and present. The TLAs obviously consider that arguing technical niceties about whether a proposal passes the gateway test is an ineffective way to make provision for the operation and upgrading that infrastructure. The point I make in 13 is that a lot of this infrastructure is not an optional activity for the TLAs. There's often no option but to accept stormwater and wastewater reticulation into the network. So in practical terms, it is much more consistent with the sustainable management purpose of the RMA for consent decisions to focus on the merits of a proposal, such as whether the site is appropriate, is the technology appropriate, are upgrades required, and what is an appropriate set of conditions or term, are key issues that absolutely should be the focus of a decision maker's interrogation, rather than in our submission deciding whether we've passed the gateway test or not. The TLAs do recognise that Environment Southland ought to retain a discretion to refuse a consent in appropriate circumstances if a particular site or proposal is not justified for some resource management reason. So this is a not a situation where the TLAs are trying to get out of the merits being assessed, absolutely assess the merits, but that can be achieved by discretionary activity status. So the TLAs fundamentally seek some better recognition in Objective 6 and relevant policies to recognise this. Also the suite of rules 5, 6, 15 and 33, as they relate to community infrastructure, should default to discretionary activity rather than non-compliant. I've gone then through the structure of the rules and dealing firstly with wastewater. Rule 33 specifically deals with community wastewater and the focus of the TLA's submission was to try and encapsulate all aspects of wastewater in that rule as effectively a code for community wastewater. It certainly deals with discharge to land, but not to water. And the issue that we see is that a discharge from a community wastewater to water defaults into the catch-all rules 5 and 6, rendering that probably a non-complying activity. So the thrust of the issue in terms of wastewater is that the proposed plan has a rule dealing with community discharges, and the TLAs submit to you that it ought to apply to land and water discharges and be a discretionary activity for both so that the merits can be assessed for those particular proposals. I've just said in 18 that if ultimately you don't accept that and that you see it as appropriate that Rule 5 and 6, the catch-all rules, still apply to community wastewater, we are asking for some carve-out so that the community wastewater defaults again to discretionary rather than non-compliant for the points I've already made. But the clear preference is that the Rule 33 be applied to all discharges. The 42A report did obviously look at this, and I've just set out in 19 what I saw as the summary of the reasons that wasn't followed. And that seemed to be along the lines that if the discharge is necessary, it has other benefits, but nevertheless potentially reduces water quality, it should be non-complying activity. Now, the issue with Rule 5 and why it's always non-complying is that the rule has a prohibition or a standard that the discharge does not contain any raw sewage. Now, from a wastewater treatment system, it's almost impossible, if not entirely impossible, for anyone to certify that there will never be raw sewage coming through the system at all. So that none of the technical experts will ever be able to say, I can categorically assure the decision maker that rule will never be breached at all. So a consent would have to be made out of an abundance of caution at the very least under that rule as a non-complying activity. Moving then to stormwater, and the principle is largely the same, but we're dealing with different rules. So for stormwater, Rule 15 specifically addresses stormwater discharges. There's subparts to the rule. The first part, 15A, makes discharge a permitted activity provided the discharge is not from a reticulated system. And of course for TLAs that will largely never apply because they will always be reticulated. 15B makes stormwater discharges discretionary where 15A is not met. That's fine. The issue arises under C, which is makes breach of the rule a non-complying activity where the discharge does not contain any sewage. And again, we start delving into practical issues, and the practical issue is there is no wastewater engineer who will certify that a stormwater system has absolutely no sewage in all under all circumstances and loads. So that rule will be breached, at least. It can't be demonstrated or be complied with, so therefore, again, it will be non-complying activity. Consent sought. So the solution that the TLAs have put forward is that subparagraph C be deleted and breaches of 15A N or B are processed as a discretionary activity. If you don't like that, then there's the point I've made in terms of wastewater is appropriate. Again, we would request a caveat for community reticulated stormwater systems are treated as a discretionary activity. The 42A report obviously has looked at this, and I've set out what I understood to be the reasoning why that wasn't preferred. One of the points that we do take issue with in terms of the 42A report is it identified in that passage that the author did not consider the costs outweigh the need to better manage discharges, and a non-complying activity status was therefore appropriate. The report, however, doesn't identify whether physical upgrades to stormwater reticulation are even possible or practicable, nor has there been quantification of what the cost of that might be or any potential improvement in the receiving waters as a result of cost, and even whether such costs are affordable at all. So we've presented evidence, and you've obviously read it, and it'll be summarised to you, and you can ask questions about the efforts that the TLAs are going to identify cross-contamination between stormwater and wastewater, the renewals programs and the like, and also the cost to the community of this long-range infrastructure that it is to upgrade. So I say that in paragraph 32, it's the TLA's position that significant investment is occurring on stormwater renewals programs and investigation of infiltration to constantly improve the reticulation network. Ultimately, though, under this proposed rule, stormwater renewal consents will still need to be processed as a non-complying activity. One principle that is important to bear in mind and is a driving force from the TLAs is that they consider each dollar spent on infrastructure should actually be spent on the infrastructure, not arguing, paying people like myself to argue gateway tests and the like. You know, spending on the upgrade is where the money should go, rather than planning in legal debates about a gateway test and potential appeals if a gateway test has failed and critical infrastructure is refused for a technical reason.
Yeah.
Absolutely, the merits should be considered though, and we don't shy away from that. You may or may not be familiar, I don't know, but we wanted to highlight for you in 34, there's been a recent example of this in practice, and that is the Invercargill City Council recently applied for renewals for its stormwater discharge consents on a global basis. It was processed under Rules 6 and 15. The 42A report did recommend that both gateway tests were failed and the application should be refused. I understand the decision is awaited on that, but that was the planning advice to the committee, and of course there's evidence on that. The report writer did identify the options for Invercargill City Council, and I've quoted that out of the 42A report from the hearing, and there was recognition that it would leave the TLA in an invidious position and unable to lawfully operate its infrastructure, but recommended it either appeal, upgrade the system, or apply for a plan change to alter the rules, objectives and policies to make the discharge permitted, or at least make it possible for a consent to be approved. And you can imagine the TLA's dissatisfaction with facing the prospect of a stormwater infrastructure that is unlawful. It is a key factor in its operations, and really that is an unacceptable outcome from the TLA's point of view. So the third point, that's why we're here really, to make application to you for a rule and objective and policy regime so that the merits of these proposals can at least be assessed in the round and balanced against the benefits of the infrastructure, the environmental improvements such infrastructure provide, and obviously the effects on the environment need to all be weighed, and we say discretionary activity is the way to do that. I've quoted some law at you, and I don't want to dwell on other than to highlight really in 36, one of the key reasons that the objective and policy and rule framework is so critical these days is King Salmon and Davidson decisions, whereby, you know, on a particular consent, it may well turn out to be that the entire focus is on the framework and the plan, and there is no recourse to part two to weigh in the benefits of infrastructure at all. So if the benefits don't flow through into some recognition in the plan itself, they may well not be a relevant consideration. And that's a good part of why we're here, to impress on you that the policy and objective framework does need to reflect, as I've taken you through the higher level document, the critical nature of the infrastructure, and to make provision for its operation and upgrade is a really important factor. I've attached to the back of the submission a decision of the Environment Court where there was a discussion between the purpose of a discretionary and a non-complying activity when establishing a plan. I don't plan to go through that other than to highlight three principles which I've summarised in paragraph 37, which I think are important and support what I'm saying to you. The court identified that both discretionary and non-complying activities are assessed as a general discretion under 104B. Secondly, that a non-complying activity must first pass one of the thresholds set out in 104D, and if it does, it's considered on the same statutory basis as a discretionary activity. So that is important, because that comes back to my principle that it is the merits of a proposal that needs to be assessed and weighed and decide whether a consent is granted or not. So whether it's non-complying or discretionary, ultimately the same evaluation is made, but the gateway test might preclude that for this particular infrastructure. And C, a prior threshold under 104D can amount to a further restriction on a potential consent, which does not necessarily add anything to the assessment under 104. So I commend that decision to you, because it does summarise those principles, I think, and highlights ultimately why we say discretionary is appropriate for this particular infrastructure. Moving away to a slightly different topic, there is an issue raised in the submission about closed landfills, and really the key point there is that there's a date in the rule identifying a risk assessment needs to be submitted over 2 years ago in the rule to fit within that rule. Now, there might be an issue about whether a rule can apply retrospectively to that. When the rule comes in, it has legal effect on the date it's made, and it's requiring something to have happened in the past, which from a BIRES point of view might be an interesting debate one day, but we'd rather not have it, because what we're saying is the substance of the issue is important. It is the risk assessment, and if the risk assessment done under the methodology identifies the risk is low, then it should have the activity status that the plan identifies. When that risk assessment is submitted, whether it's before or after that particular date, really should make no difference in environmental terms. Second issue is relating to water abstraction in the Waiau catchment, and this only applies to the Southland District Council and an issue raised in its submission. There is an aspect of this rule that treats, well, I'll go back a sec. So, water takes in that catchment for particular purposes of discretionary activity unless there's a potential hydraulic connection with the river, which then makes the activity non-compliant. The council has asked for advice about whether any of its takes have a hydraulic connection to the river, and its advice is attached to Mr. Evans' evidence, which he can explain to you, but I'm sure you've had a quick look at. All of those takes have potential hydraulic connection to the river, or will be therefore non-complying activities. The point the council makes is that the volume of the takes for potable and stock water out of that catchment having a connection to the Waiau River. There's not a material resource management issue, and those should be, again, assessed as a discretionary activity on the merits. I respond just to 2 points made in the opening submissions on behalf of Environment Southland, and there were two passages which my clients did take slight issue with. Firstly, in paragraph 16, Mr. Moore, and I quote the passage he submitted to you, and I presume he did so, I just read his written submissions. He talks there about that the plan seeks to restrict the direct discharge of stormwater and sewage to water. And I highlight the word restrict. And so I say in response, it is submitted that the proposed plan does not contain an objective or policy seeking to restrict. And restrict is a very narrow term in terms of, to see a restriction on stormwater or wastewater discharges is a concept that the TLAs shudder at. But policy 14 expresses a preference for discharges of contaminants to land over water, sure. But a preference is not the same as restricting discharges to water. The suggestion that the proposed plan seeks to restrict discharges is not consistent with the proposed RPS and the higher order documents previously referred to. And there's also a part in his conclusion where he identifies in his submission that the TLAs are submitting that it's more economically efficient to further restrict discharges from rural land rather than focusing on stormwater and sewage systems. And I'd say in response to that, the TLAs have not submitted that it is more economically efficient to further restrict discharges from rural land uses. This is not an issue where the TLAs are saying there should be any changes to the rules or objectives and policies framework relating to rural land use or agricultural activity or farming activity at all. That is an issue for the Regional Council to determine. The point the TLAs are making is that rendering its critical infrastructure applications non-complying is unduly onerous. That does not shy away from the merits of those proposals being appropriately assessed in light of the relevant planning framework when resource consent applications inevitably must be made for such infrastructure. And this is certainly not a situation where the TLAs are seeking some lenience at the expense of the rural community. That's simply a miscategorisation of the TLA's position. So my conclusion is set out, and it really does just reinforce the points I've already made, so I don't really propose to labour that any further. So those are the things I wanted to cover for you. I'm happy to answer any questions of a legal nature, or we'll move to the witnesses.
No, we'll take questions of yourself and then each witness is there.
Sure, thank you.
Just to let you know and the witnesses know, there's probably at least half of the witnesses that I don't have any questions for. Now, I just want to make it clear that's not because of a lack of interest or a lack of understanding. And just to give that some context, in my role as a hearings commissioner, I've sat on consent hearings for over 25 wastewater discharge consents, primarily in the North Island. And before the Auckland Regional Council became the Auckland Unitary Authority, I was project manager for the Regional Discharges Project and was the processing officer for the North Shore and Auckland City Stormwater and Wastewater Network discharge consents. So I'm extremely familiar with the issues that you raised in your submissions and in the evidence, and that in part is why I don't have many questions for some of the witnesses.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you.
Now I'll see if we have questions for you. Lloyd, start again.
No questions for me.
No questions.
No,
no,
it's very clear what you are asking us to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just three things I wanted to raise with you. And two of them are not really questions at all, but I note the point you make at your paragraph 34 about the existing application that's been recommended for declining by the reporting officer.
Yes.
And understand that places that applicant in an extremely difficult position, because even if we were to change the rules and the plan as you request, of course that application remains non-compliant,
yes,
under Section 88 capital A. So
that's
understand
right.
It puts you between a rock and a very hard place. I do have one question though in terms of paragraph 40 and rule 52.
Yes.
Do you happen to have with you the section 42A report and the recommended amendments to that rule? And if not, we can give you a copy because I want to ask you a question about it.
Okay. No, I don't think I can label it.
We've got, please. Have you got it then?
It's on the table, yes, so if you can take me to where that...
I'm not quite sure what page would be in your, it's lovely filling with my copy, but...
There's a copy of the plan with the track changes in here as well, if you...
Yep. No, I'm familiar with the plan.
Yeah, but I want you to look at the track changes.
Oh, sorry, I've changed the rule. Yep, thank you.
Round about page 86.
Yeah, rule 52.
86. 89.
Yeah, rule 52.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you have existing tanks in that catchment for any kind of activity and they're sought to be renewed or replaced, wouldn't they be covered by 52A Romans 1? And they'd be discretionary?
Provided the volume's not increasing. Now, if particularly, say, Te Anau take, might well need to have a slightly increased take given the population increase, so that's a yet another rider in the rule. So if the renewal is exactly like for like, yes, you're right. If there's a potential increase, then no.
Okay. And so the witness that I could ask about if any of those replacement takes are likely to increase in volume would
yes.
be which witness?
Ian Evans. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Evans, can you just not now, but when you come to present your evidence, just remember that I'd like to understand if any of those existing tanks are likely to increase in volume
yes.
when you replace them. That'd be great.
Thank you.
And just one final point.
Sorry, and the second part of that rule is that the use is not changing, and presumably that would be satisfied.
Unless you wanted to get into some kind of other business. And paragraph 36, you brought to your attention King, Salmon and Davidson, which we're very familiar with.
Yep.
There's also another decision, which was a Judge Jackson decision, appealing Wanakarank versus Queenstown Lakes District Council. It was a 2015 decision, New Zealand Environment Court number 139. That decision, and I'm not sure if it's been challenged in the High Court or not, was that if you're a decision maker on a resource consent application, and if you had a regional district plan that was operative and had been developed under an operative RPS, and you didn't even need to refer up to the RPS, you only looked at the plan. And so that reinforces the point you're making, which we really do understand, that the relevant provisions in the superior instruments need to be properly reflected in the lower order instruments. So I understand the point you're making and understand there's a body of case law that drives us in that direction.
Yeah.
Thank you. Great, so we can go to your first witness.
So the first witness being